What's going on? What's happening, blues people? As you know, we celebrate and raise awareness of African American traditional music and the Black experience. And one of the most important ways of doing that is through folklorism, ethnography, and ethnomusicology. Many people do this and aren't even aware that these terms exist. And I guess we call them community activists or community folklorists. But I'm honored to be speaking with February's African American Folklorist of the Month, Miss Wanda Addison. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm fairly well. I'm doing good. I'm actually very groovy and excited because before we get into your story, I would like to set this up like this. And this is something I've been speaking to other Black folk, brown folk in the folklore, ethnography, ethnomusicology industry in regards of the academic industry, that there are a plethora of Black folk, for lack of a better term, that does this kind of work, engage in this kind of work, but one, don't know or possibly don't care to know the terminologies, and two, are not even aware this is actually a viable career path. And they do it in their own independent way. What's your thoughts about that and connecting the two?
I think you're right when you talk about people not knowing that folklore is a thing or that what they do every day is connected to folklore. Before I started folklore, so to speak, before I became a folklorist, I didn't know what folklore was. I had no idea. I didn't know that there was such a thing as foodways, which is the study of the food that a culture makes and the value of that food to that culture, the meaning of it, the making of it. I didn't know that stories that I grew up hearing about my grandmother were part of what is termed folklore. I had no idea. And so for me, it wasn't a lack of wanting to know. It was simply not having that vocabulary and or not having that knowledge base. And so I think you're absolutely spot on when you say that so many people are doing folklore work and they don't know that what they're doing is folklore.
So with that being said, let's get into your story. In your story, we can circle back to that topic in regards to how do we bridge that gap. So you said when you first got into it, you yourself weren't aware. So how did you stumble upon this concept of folklore?
I decided to pursue higher education. So I was ending my master's program. I was getting ready to get my master's in English, and it felt like it wasn't done, if you know that feeling, like there's more there.
Right.
And I just decided, I will say that I believe that God put it in my spirit that there was more to do, that there was more for me to do. And so I applied for the PhD program at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, in Lafayette, Louisiana. And I was accepted into the program. I received a fellowship because of the smidgen percentile above what I needed to be when I took the graduate exam. And I am thankful for that. Otherwise, I would not have been able to go. But when I started there, I had full intentions of getting a PhD in literature only, in English only literature, still didn't know what folklore was. And two of my first three classes were folklore classes. They ended up being folklore classes. One was a folklore and literature class, and one was a seminar in folklore. And in the seminar in folklore class, there was one assignment where we had to choose a journal, and the professor gave a list of journals for us to choose from. And I kind of hemmed and hawed, and there ended up only being like three journals or something left. And I chose the one titled Oral Literature. And that was the name of the journal. And so we had to research it and then do a presentation. So I went to the library, looked at a bunch of the journals, and there was this article about Indian women and the stories that they told. And when I tell you that a light bulb went off for me in that moment, I can't be more precise than that. It was an aha moment that I was like, I didn't know people were doing this. I didn't know this was a thing. No. I didn't know hearing women's stories and valuing them and uplifting them. I didn't know sitting around the table and sharing your life through your personal experience stories was a thing. And from that moment on, that moment in the library, I became a folklorist. Even though I didn't yet claim the title, I was a folklorist. There was simply no turning back. And honestly, there was nothing else I wanted to study. There was nothing else I wanted to know. I had found my home in folklore.
So is it fair to say, considering your story, and I identify with your story 100%, this is a calling. It has to be a calling, because it's not like the most lucrative business unless you're a professor, correct?
And you know, there could be question marks about it being lucrative as a professor, let me tell you. But it's financially rewarding in that sense. Are you, you know, chances are you're not going to make millions and millions of dollars as a folklorist. Yes. that's probably not going to happen.
But it is a calling, though. This is something that it's like a calling, a mission that you were given.
In some cases, yes. I do believe that's the case, that there is something bigger than you, the person, that is reaching out to you. And I don't want to make it sound very touchy feely or anything like that. Right. It's the same or very similar with other professions. A doctor who is a cardiologist knows that they're good at that. And they know that that's exactly the work that they should be doing.
Right.
It's a very similar thing. When you know that the work that you're called to do is about shining a light on other people's work. And that's part of what folklorists do. They shine a light on other people's traditions, and they value those traditions. People want to be heard and seen. And part of what folklorists do is they come and they say, I hear you, I see you, I value you, and I respect what you do.
Now, that's a very, very important, and I hate to say it, it's a touchy statement. And when I say touchy, I don't mean touchy as risque. I mean touchy as emotion pulling, you know, because in the big picture, and I make joke, but in the big, honest picture, there's a multitude of people who do not feel heard.
Yes, that's exactly right. And they do not feel seen. One of the things that I noticed a gap when I was in Louisiana, and because I was not born and raised in Louisiana, I was very much an outsider to that South Louisiana Cajun and Creole culture. And so as an outsider, what I noticed that there seemed to be a gap in, or the voices of African American or Black Creole women over 50. And it was very clear to me that those voices were going to be lost if they weren't recorded in greater numbers. So that was something early on that was a big a big deal for me. And that has since grown for me. Actually, I think the seed was probably planted earlier, even prior to my going to Louisiana, around issues dealing with elders, and specifically women elders. And so that seed was watered in when I was in Louisiana. And from there, it has simply continued to grow. And my focus continues to be women's voices, women's stories, particularly women over 50, right. Because those experiences are different in some ways, in many ways, than women who are under 30 or even under 40. And there's value and significant value in who these women are, who they have been, who they will be. There's value in the stories that they tell. There's value in their experiences. And I don't want us as a culture to lose those voices. That's just something that is my passion. That is hands down my number one passion. And for me, that's also connected around issues of home and belonging. Mm. So those are just very important things for me.
No, they are. You know, I have a question, but before I get to the question, I just want to add to your statement how powerful it is, because being a bluesman and having many blues cats and kittens in my age range, one of my fellow blues brothers brought to my attention, who's in my age group. Mm-hmm. He was like, you know, there are two groups of blues musicians who people notice, relish, and really make a big fuss over. And that's the 30 and under, 25 and under, and that's the 65 and over. But there's this group of people nobody seems to care about. Mm-hmm. So as you express your story, I think about even the slave narratives when they were the WPA slave narrative, when they was interviewing the children of slaves, the first quote unquote free. They were interviewing 80, 70, 90 year old people. Mm. You know, so it's like, you know, you're either interviewing or telling the story of the kids, or you're telling the story of the elders that are about to ascend. That's a very unique and very important group of people that you represent. Now, here's my question, specifically based on you saying, I noticed women at this age were not being documented, recorded, their stories weren't being heard. How did you notice that? What brought this to your attention?
I think mainly it was just observation, honestly. Again, as an outsider, you know, when you're not within your culture, even though I'm Southern, I was born and raised in Memphis. The Southwest Louisiana culture is different from the Mid-South culture that I grew up in. Mm. The Cajun and Creole experience is different from the African-American experience that I had in the Mid-South. They have their own experience as Creoles of color, as well as African-American women. And obviously the Cajun experience is very unique to that area as well.
Right.
So I'm bringing to Southwest Louisiana, specifically Lafayette, I'm bringing to that area and the surrounding towns my previous experiences of what I'm used to seeing. I'm used to seeing African-American women out front. I'm used to seeing African-American women's voices in some way seen and heard. And that seemed to be missing in significant ways for me when I was there. And then what we were studying at the university, I'm like, I wonder what women over 50. I wonder what their life experiences were like. Because we were reading about lots of people's experiences. We were reading about lots of things in folklore. We were certainly reading about literature, my folklore and lit class, and then my other literature classes as well. And I just began to wonder. And then Zora Neale Hurston, who will forever have my heart. I love her just like I love James Baldwin. They are two of my favorite writers. Mm. And so I'm reading her work, most of which I was not that familiar with. And I'm reading everything that she did as this African-American woman in the early 20th century, who was a folklorist, who was an ethnographer, who was an anthropologist, who went out and said, Black people are fabulous. Let me tell you who we are. And I'm reading her Mules and Men, and I'm reading their Eyes Were Watching God, and I'm reading her some of her other short stories. And I'm like, yes, 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 yes. And that just, it just sort of evolved. Like there's not a linear trajectory. It's really all of the pieces just sort of fell into place because that's where I was supposed to be. And so things just sort of fell in the right place for me. It doesn't mean the trajectory was always smooth, because it wasn't, but I knew that what I was seeing was not an accident. And I wanted to hear from these women who were not the women that I had grown up knowing. And I wanted to hear from them. I wanted to hear who they were. I wanted to hear their experiences. And so I did a few interviews, and my dissertation is based on that. But I did interviews for classes as well. And it was just, it was one of the richest experiences outside of Memphis that I'd ever had. It was just fabulous being there.
So with that beginning, have you, and I believe you mentioned this, but I still want to ask to get the juice.
Sure.
With that beginning, has your tenure became going around to different cultures, whether it's different Black cultures or different ethnic cultures, documenting, recording, and helping tell the story of women in this age group?
That is my vision. You speak my vision and my desire into the universe. That I would be thrilled to be able to do that. That is really something that I want to do. And I want to do it in this country, because the American experience of Black people is different in some ways for very specific reasons than other countries. And so I desire greatly to do that. And so perhaps one day I will be able to travel around the country, setting up interviews, similar to what Randall Keenan was able to do in, I think the name of his book is Walking on Water or something like that. It's several years old, but it's so good. And that's the kind of thing that I want to do. Now, within my own little world here in San Diego, where I teach at a local university, and because I'm not in a folklore program, there aren't very many folklore programs. And so I'm in an English department because my degree is in English. I have been able to connect with a local Black storytelling group. It's called the Black Storytellers of San Diego. Mm. And so I've been able to have somewhat of a partnership, so to speak, with them over the last probably 8 to 10 years. And I've certainly been able to interview some of them and just support the work that they do in this community with storytelling and uplifting Black culture.
Now, if they have a website or any type of media along with your Twitter handle and everything, we can definitely link that to this interview if you would like.
Sure. I can absolutely send you there. They have a website and they have a Facebook page too, but I'm not on Facebook, so I would have to get that from them. Right. But, they do have a Facebook page and they do have a website. So I'll reach out to the president or the vice president and let them know that you would like to, post their contact info. And I'm sure they won't have any issue with that at all. I'm sure they would welcome it. And I can certainly give you my Twitter handle, which I post a lot of non-folklore related stuff, just so you know. I do not live in, folklore because everything is, it sounds so nonsensical, perhaps is the right word to say that everything is folklore because it feels like you're watering it down. But the reality is that there are so many things that we experience every day, the stories we tell around those things. Other professions are actually doing folklore-like work and don't realize it. So the work that sociologists do, some of that work is folklore type of work, the ethnography work that they do. There are other professions, anthropologists, of course, they do their own sort of work and they are ethnographers as well. So they're not, some may be folklorists, but not all identify as that, but fields that are completely outside of that, of the realm of anthropology or folklore, there are several of them that are doing folklore type work. Sociology comes to mind, right off.
But, let me ask you this. I'm happy you brought that up because this is a great segue, because this is something that I've asked others in this academic space, and some that dance between the two, the academic and community, based on what their focus is. If, in fact, and I set it up like this, not because it's not true, but, I watched a lot of Perry Mason growing up.
I too love Perry Mason. Okay, good.
If, in fact, a lot of these spaces, sociology, history for that matter, literature, archaeology, all these things embody folklore to some degree, why do a percentage, I don't want to make a, I'm trying not to make a blanket statement, but why do a percentage of them not rely on the folklore in their study or document as if it's not a scientific fact? Do you understand my question?
I'm not sure. So,
why do they think folklore is not a historical fact in some cases? So when they're like, oh, well, this is the folklore, but instead of going to the people to get the history, let's go to this textbook. And because this textbook is going to tell us what really happened. But if we go to the folklore of the people, that might be contrived, made up, or exaggerated. So we cannot rely on that as scientific evidence for this dissertation or paper. You understand my question?
Right. And so I'm going to answer it, but if I'm not hitting your point, let me know.
Okay.
I think for some, they don't even think about folklore. People don't think about folklore as a discipline. And so they don't recognize the value of people's experiences that have not yet been captured in a succinct form. So if I can go to a book and say, I understand the people now, those people, whomever they might be, I get them now because this book has told me who they are. Then I think I understand. But if I have to go, or if I decide to go to that particular group of people in their space, then I don't know yet what I've missed, because I'm presuming that the book has told me everything. When I go to their space, perhaps I might find it messy. Perhaps I might find it difficult. Perhaps I might find it challenging to navigate, to negotiate. It's because, especially if you're thinking about it in the concept of science, it's not cut and dried, because human beings are not cut and dried. And so if I'm valuing a published text as a scientific, or at the very least vetted document,
vetted, yes,
implying truth, then the anecdotal pieces of individual lives are not always valued. And that's across the board.
Yeah.
Because it's very easy, and I've certainly heard people say many, many times, that something is anecdotal. This thing is anecdotal. And when they say that, that discounts, whether they intend to or not, they are discounting that person's experience or that group's experience. Mm. And when you do that, there is a move of erasure that happens at that point. But what I think some people fail to understand, and perhaps some disciplines as well, I don't want to overreach here.
Okay.
But what is sometimes failed to be understood is there is truth in the anecdotal. It doesn't mean that you stop at two people's stories. But if you have a community and 100 people are telling you very similar things, have very similar experiences, then it ceases to be anecdotal at that point. Mm. If you have 20 people, it's probably no longer anecdotal. And that invites further study, further research, further ethnography. But if you've captured 2 million people's lives in a 500-page book, and you think that that is truth, and so you know everything, that's where the highly problematic start to happen. Regardless of where that culture is, it would be the same where if it's in another country, or if it's in a federal prison, or if it's in a state prison. That is a culture. State prisons have their own culture. Federal prisons have their own culture. Police departments have their culture. Every institution has its own culture. And from that institution, there will be stories told. And so there is a folklore of that institution.
So let me ask you, is it arrogant then for the thought to be, let me go, you know, interview all these people and then try to, for lack of a better word, but also being somewhat sarcastic, civilize them? Because you made it clear, if it's 120 or more people, this is not really an issue. This is a lifestyle, right? So when in studying different groups of people, would it then be a tad bit arrogant for those studying the people to gather the information and then, well, let me see how I can change them?
If their goal is to change, that's problematic from the start. If their goal is to learn, then that's a different set of motivations there. So one thing I think folklorists learn, they've come to learn, we continue to learn, I believe, is how humbling what we do is.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
We are not the experts. I cannot walk into, as a folklorist, when I first met, and I'll use the Black Storytellers of San Diego as an example again, when I first met them, and I met the then founding, the founder and president, who has since passed on. But when I first met her, it would have been incredibly arrogant of me to think that I could tell her about storytelling. Mm. I was not there to tell her about storytelling. I was there to hear what she had to say. And if I were interviewing, if I was out and interviewing a group of people or just one person, and I wanted to hear their story, I'm not there to do anything but hear them. I'm there to listen. I'm there to capture. I'm there to get, soak it up, get whatever I can. I'm a sponge at that point, because right. I want to learn and I want to know. If my goal, however, to go back to your initial point, if my goal is to somehow make them accessible to other people, I would have to question that thought process for myself. Right. If my goal is to civilize them, again, I would have to question the thought process, the action of anyone who was attempting to do that or thought that that was possible. Do books help bring understanding about cultures that we don't know or people that we don't know? They can, absolutely. There's significant value in books in part for that reason. Is it a point of civilization? I don't think so. That's not how I would view it. But again, it's not to say that there aren't books whose motivation was that thing. Because I'm sure that there probably are. Or there certainly have been in the past, if not currently.
Well, let's I try to keep it in the present and the future. Because, sure. But I want to go to the past for a minute. And just on a side note, one of the reasons why I try to keep it to the present, because I think a lot of people currently become overlooked because of our reverence and respect for what happened yesterday. But that's neither here nor there. Mm-hmm. Old school, turn of the century, from turn of the century to the 60s. And this is more, I don't even want to say more prevalent in Black music, because when you go to Black communities, areas, any type of art or whatever, and you kind of see this. Do you believe one of the issues, I guess, that a lot of people a lot of Black people in the last 30 or 40, 50 years have with the earlier folklorism of our counterparts, or white folklorists, or non-Black, is that in some cases it appears as if they're going to these communities to interview, but telling them what their story is? And do you see some of that reflect today? Because I do.
I'm intrigued by what you're seeing today. Do you mind talking a little bit about that?
I do not mind at all. I it's predominantly in blues, in the blues scene. But okay. What happens is, in these conversations, when white blues historians, not all, so I have to say that, because when I just say white, that's a blanket statement. Mm-hmm. Not all, but a good portion of them tell Black people and everybody else what our story is and how we're supposed to receive it in regards to an expression that will stem through us, through our experience. And that usually scatters into other parts of the Black experience and history that they also wish to tell us the story of. So to be more specific, you know, early in my folklorist career, when I didn't know I was a folklorist, and I'm having these debates with people, they call themselves debunking me because they read it in a book by that was written by a non-Black person. It was an autobiography of a Black person who spoke in a coded language to the white person. Mm-hmm. And they're telling me, I don't know what I'm talking about, when I got the story directly from the horse's mouth, which was granddaddy, great granddaddy, uncles, and people who lived amongst these people they're reading about. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like I found it was, and I make this joke, but they say the truth in comedy. It's a group of white people, particularly white men, jockeying to see who's best suited to tell a Black person's story. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's mm-hmm. what I'm asking. And I do mm-hmm. see it today. There are a good small group that don't subscribe to that. And then there's another group that are the antithesis of that, but their agenda is not much different than those white men jockeying to tell the Black man's story. So it's just kind of, or Black woman, please forgive mm-hmm. me, because yeah, yeah. it's Black people's story. So, mm-hmm. you know, I've seen this, and it's something that's carried on. And to be more specific with the question, do you believe that in this day and age, a lot of the documented work from yesterday, they don't want to refute because whether they knew at the time was, I say loosely whether they knew if they was wrong at the time. I say that loosely because how about this? As they got older, their experience and their mindset evolved and I could have handled it better. Or I could have did this, that, or the third. However, they've made a tenure and a career and a living at this. So if they retract some of these things, that could be detrimental. So do you think that also plays a part in how things work?
I think that, yes. Does it? Is there a measure of that happening still? There absolutely is, of course. In part because there is no shortage of people trying to tell African Americans about their own experience. Mm. And in turn, refusing to hear.
Correct.
What African Americans are saying about their own experience, the height of arrogance, but it's also a certain amount of fear, a certain amount of blindness. they just don't even see. Sometimes people don't see. Because one thing that many people fail to see is their implicit bias. People don't see their bias. Regardless of the amount of training, you also have to be willing to do the work to see that we all have biases, regardless of who you are. If you are living and breathing and over a certain age, maybe, I don't know, five, mm-hmm. you have an implicit bias about something. Now, in this case, we're talking specifically around race and gender issues. There is a bias around that. And once we can begin to see that that bias exists within us, then we can begin to mitigate it and interrogate it and be aware of it showing up in the work that we do. That we need to learn to be quiet and step aside. And that can happen when we're very educated. That absolutely can happen where, because I've studied, and I'll use your example about blues music, but to be clear, I haven't studied it, but let's say that I had. So let's say that I was an ethnomusicologist. Nothing against them. I'm using them as an example. Ethnomusicologists do great work. But let's say that I I had studied blues. That was my specialty. I need to recognize that because I've studied a thing and I know it well from that viewpoint, and I may have interviewed many, many people and written multiple books, who knows? But there's an expertise that I have in that focus.
Right.
When I am interviewing musicians, when I'm interviewing blues musicians, it can be a conversation, but I am first going to bow to their expertise because they have an expertise that I might not have. Unless I am a blues musician of a certain era, of a certain age, of a certain race or gender, I don't know what they know. And even if I am the same race and gender of them, and I have this great degree and this great expertise, this knowledge base, I haven't lived their experience. And that it's the recognizing how we should remove ourselves from that space of bias or expertise and bow to the knowledge of the person that has agreed to speak with us and be interviewed by us. So is that happening now? Yes. Is it with intention? Sometimes. Is it simply a lack of awareness? Sometimes. When we think about past work of folklorists as well as others, we have to recognize that there are two points that we have to recognize for me. One is that they were working out of the time at which they were working.
Right.
And so things that were done, things that were said, things that were approached, how they dealt with people that they were interviewing, how they saw them, how they referred to them in their writing can be highly offensive to us now with our 21st century sensibilities.
Correct. Well, today everything's offensive to everyone.
Exactly, because we are all ready to be offended at any moment. But the reality is that it can some of it will be highly offensive to us in this day and time. The challenge is to recognize, accept, and acknowledge the shortcomings that exist in the work and then the value that the work may have brought to bear. They're not mutually exclusive sometimes. And quite frankly, in 100 years, in 50 years, when people are combing through some of our works, some of our products, some of the things that we've done and put out into the world in writing, in digital spaces, they might absolutely find our way of talking, our way of thinking to be ridiculous and short-sighted and offensive.
That is true.
But does that mean that for some of us, the work that we produced, that because those things exist, it's not without value? There is value still there, but because of the time out of which we're producing it in this early 21st century and the 20th century for some of us. In the year 2200, people would be going, oh my God, why are they referring to people like that? How dare they? We can't know. We can only do the best that we can do being as aware as we can be right now.
No, I hear that. To the point, I may have to ask you to use that as a foreword of a project that I'm currently working on about the Lomax legacy. because you kind of wrapped up everything in that statement. you know, because there was a time period where there was different beliefs, different things going on, and different colloquialisms for different groups of people. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Now, also in regards of bias, which I would like to touch on, because what I received, and tell me if I'm wrong, we have to get ourselves out of the way to get the honest truth of what and who we're interviewing, right? So remove the ego and that great, I have a point to prove to all of you people. This is what you're saying.
Yep. Significantly so. And to be sure, there's a time where we re-enter that space. And that time is when we are sitting at our desk with the interview and we are transcribing it. Mm. We are not removed at that point, because we can't be to a certain degree. We have to be present in many different ways in the transcription as we're analyzing the transcription, as we're analyzing the interview. And we're considering what is there. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be aware of our biases, because we absolutely should still be aware of them. But when we are in the midst of the interview, in the midst of the space with that person or those people, mm-hmm. yes, we sort of need to be a little bit more invisible. But when we are doing our transcription, when we are doing our writing, every single thing written has an agenda. There's no published thing out there without an agenda.
That is true.
And so we need to figure out, what are we hoping to achieve with this thing that we are writing? And who are we hoping to impact? Who are we hoping will see this? What's our goal? And then begin to work to make that come to bear, or to question it, as the case may be. From there, then we can produce something of value.
Okay. Now, with that being said, because I for the most part, what I was going to ask you initially was, what would you tell an up-and-coming folklorist? But everything you said, I believe, is what you would tell them. So,
just really quickly, sure. I would tell them to find the thing that you love about folklore and put your whole heart and soul to it. Okay. Don't let anyone tell you, no, you can't. Don't let anyone tell you it's not a value. Don't let anyone tell you no one wants to hear about those people over there, that group over there. Don't believe them. If the passion is in you to do that thing, go do it. Because it is not always about who else. Sometimes it's just about the people who have agreed to allow you to hang out with them and to interview them and to see them.
And I mean, that's a lot, because that's pretty much welcoming someone into your home.
Yes.
Which should be respected. So now, with that being said, what would you tell the group of people that do this work, this documentation, this study, research, et cetera, and interviews and everything, but don't know they're folklorists, don't know there's an industry that they can tap into however they want to? And to be specific, they are from the Black community in low to no income areas, but they find their story, or the story of their people, you know, whatever the story is, very intriguing, and they're working to get these stories out. What would you tell them, and how would you present to them how they can connect the two worlds?
The first thing I would tell them is to keep doing the work that you're doing, that there is value in that work. The next thing would be to join organization, even if it's just signing up on the website to begin with. You know, you might not have money to actually join. But the American Folklore Society, for example, has a website that you can access information. There are going to be certain things you can't access because if you're not a member, but they have resources on the website. You can, if there's a folklore conference near you, because there are some regional folklore conferences, there are smaller ones. There's a Western States Folklore Society, for example, has a conference, usually in April on the Western States. There's the New York Folklore Society, and I don't want to keep naming them because I know I'm going to forget people. Texas has one, for example. Also, there are folklore that are not societies, but they're the local, regional. So it's either local to your city or in your general region. That I'm going to call them councils, but I don't think that's out always the case. But there's usually like a state folklorist or there's often a state folklorist. Not every state has one, I don't believe. But there are people in your state, if not in your city, that you might be able to connect with. But reach out. You can email on the AFS website, which is afsnet.org. So it's afsnet.org. I think there's a way to contact someone from the, if not the board, from the administrative part, and letting them know your project and asking them if there's someone that they could recommend who might be interested in talking to you about your project. You can do the same thing on AFS has a Facebook page that you can join. Obviously, if you're on Facebook, totally free. AFS has an Instagram page that I follow on the gram, and they have a Twitter page that I also follow. So the resources are out there, that all you need is just connect to one person who can then connect you to somebody else. So for example, if you're doing a documentary in an area that might not be my field of my expertise, chances are I probably know at least one person who I can go, hey, that's not what I do, but I can still answer general questions about certain things. But let me connect you with this person who might be able to help you where it is their expertise. It is the thing that they do the most. That's so key. And then from there, we can try to get you to a folklore conference, and that you can just be in the space with folklorists and meeting various folklorists and hearing the work that they are doing and connecting. I actually had the opportunity at the last AFS conference, in Baltimore, where I met someone who didn't even know the work that he was doing was folklore. And he's not from Baltimore. I think he was from Ohio. And I was excited. A great opportunity. Also had a full-time job and some other things going, but we encouraged him to reach out to us whenever he was ready to move forward and do more with that particular project, which would easily end up being a multi-book project. Mm. But people are busy, and since that was not the primary thing he was doing, I don't know to the degree that he's reached out to anyone yet, but I remember who he is, and I know someone who knows him. So, you know, I'm sure eventually I'm going to reach out to him and just remind him, because that's what we do also. We uplift each other's work and we want to be there as resources and mentors for other folklorists that are up and coming.
So would you say this is a unique space? And when I say unique, I mean, for what it's worth, in any industry or any endeavor, we have these things, this network base. But tapping back into your statement in regards of don't let anyone tell you those people aren't interesting enough to cover. So we have kind of a unique space where the folklorist is not looking for the popular or commercially viable story. They're looking for the story or specific story. So this, do you consider this a unique space in that regard?
I'm not sure if it's unique. I think that there are writers who are looking for the slightly offbeat thing that they might write about, so to speak. So I'm not sure how unique it is. Is it something that everyone is doing? Absolutely not. Is it special in a certain way? For me, yes, it is. But when I say don't let people tell you that that thing is not, or that, or those people are not worthy of your continued attention and engagement and study and writing about them or doing a documentary on them, that's also in recognition that, and as a reminder that they're not alone in that space, that other people have had similar situations where people have asked them, why are you studying that? What is that? Why is that important? And it's okay to say, I don't know why it's important right now, but this is why I think it's important. And you go from there. So is it unique that we see value in things that other people might tend to discount because the world is hectic and busy and people's lives are full of many, many different things? We are trained to see very specific things in very specific ways, to see possibilities where some people won't even notice a thing. Well, in some ways, maybe, yes.
So to a degree, is unique in its own space, but not necessarily, well, actually, because this is a great segue to my question for you coming out of a literature background. Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, but a piece of your answer is based on your understanding of not just literature, but being a writer and looking for the story. Yes.
I hadn't thought about it in that way, actually. I would say in some ways, yes, but a lot of it is because the story that when I think of story, and when I talk about story, I'm talking from a folklorist perspective, not from a literature person's perspective.
So there is a difference.
For me, there's a difference, yes.
Please elaborate on that, because my question was actually, does your background in literature help in direct your perception? But first, before you can answer that, you have to share with us your difference in the two.
Well, for me, so it helps me when I dive into the analysis of an interview because I am grounded in analysis. I do it almost like breathing. It's practically a part of my DNA at this point. But when I think about storytelling, I talk about storytelling in a very specific way. And again, that's also part of my training. It has everything to do with my professors. It has everything to do with where I went to school and my dissertation director, who I count as a friend to this day. He and his wife both are wonderful people. I think about storytelling not from a strictly made up performance space. And by made up, I mean stories that are created specifically to be performed. I think about storytelling as the thing that you share from yourself.
Mm.
And so when I'm talking storytelling, I'm talking personal narrative. I'm talking about the stories that people share about their lives, and not just the personal narrative piece, but, you know, this story that my grandmother told me kind of thing, and how that can be created and made and presented in a way that it is a commentary on the Black experience, as well as a commentary on the world. When I think about literature, and there is folklore, as we have already talked about in certain ways, for sure, there's folklore throughout literature, throughout literature. You know, Ernest J. Gaines, God rest his soul, recently passed, and he certainly incorporates aspects of folklore in his writing. The Ralph Ellison has a story.
Absolutely.
Folklore in his writing. So, and I named those two, but by no means are they the only two, not by any stretch of the imagination. And there are writers today that continue to do that. So it's not something from, you know, the 20th century or whatever. It will continue to be a thing because folklore is life, and people will continue to incorporate it as they try to make sense of the world. So the story of literature is the creation. It's just a different type of story for me. I'm quite sure that people will, you know, disagree. There will be people who disagree, and that's okay. That's part of good conversations. But I see a literature space as simply a different form of storytelling, and one that has value. Absolutely has value in what it can do to illuminate the world, to highlight people's experiences. It's just different.
I dig it. I'm really honored that you took the time to sit down and talk folklore and your story with us. Where can the people find you? Now is the time you can give us your Twitter handle, which I follow you, by the way. And and also your works, or written works, or whatever, any and everything that you're doing.
Well, I am on Twitter and Instagram, same handle, one, O-N-E, sun, S-U-N, girl, G-I-R-L. Same handle for both Twitter and Instagram. Again, I'm not on Facebook. Who knows if I will ever be on Facebook, but I'm not there right now. I have an article from probably 3 years ago, something like that. What year is this? It's that kind of thing. Oh, it's 2020. Okay.
It's early. We just got here.
I have an article that I did for a journal out of Canada that was attached to Cape Breton University. It's a Material Cultural Review is the title of the journal. And the article is on Black history programs. And I actually talk about the Black storytellers of San Diego in that article. I have a couple of short pieces in a collection on the Black arts movement. Those two are on Ernest J. Gaines. One is the biographical piece, and the other is on Catherine Carmier, his first novel. I have a chapter coming out in 2021 in a book entitled Advancing Folkloristics, and where I talk about being the lone folklorist in a non-folklore program, which is most folklorists are solo, most academic folklorists, you know, which is what I am. And that simply means, for your listeners, simply means that I'm a folklorist who teaches at a university, as opposed to a folklorist who is doing, who works at a museum, or who is doing other work in the public sector. And so I have that chapter that's coming out. The anticipated publication is sometime in 2021. I have a book that I am working on. It's a collection of essays that, and it's so, compiled from other non-folklorists, because this is a non-folklore project. I straddle two intellectual homes. I have two intellectual homes. I inhabit them fully, both. And one is literature and one is folklore. So my scholarship will be and continue to be in both of those spaces. The manuscript that I'm working on for the University Press of Mississippi, that is actually due this summer, very early summer, is a collection of seven, I think, essays by other scholars on Ernest J. Gaines for the 21st century.
Mm. And so we have two interviews in the future that we have to do, one for that chapter and one for this book.
I welcome the opportunity. So that, and I, of course, have another... solo Gaines book rattling around in my head that I haven't been able to get to yet, but I will get to it. His work, and I know this is a folklore thing and not on literature.
Literature is very important to for me. That's something else. See, you're not on Facebook, and I wonder if that's because of conspiracy theories. But
it's not because of conspiracy theories. I have issues with privacy stuff.
Understood. But if you ever decide to go on Facebook, or you could see on my website, but my Jack Dapper Blues Facebook group actually has the entire list. I have a post that is pinned, which is a list of African-American black literature that people should read. And so many people, you know, I started adding, but, you know, so many people have chimed in with different books. So the purpose of me sharing this with you is because I believe whether it has to do with folklore or not, literature reading is primary.
It is. It brings knowledge. It brings understanding. It just brings fun too. A well-written book, it's hard to beat sometimes, regardless of how you read it. You know, I still like a regular book in my hand. I enjoy that. But certainly I've read stuff online. So however you read, just read, just do it. Find someone that you like and just read their work and be excited about it. That's a great thing. Because I'm not on your, I don't follow you on Facebook, because I'm not there. Do you have Zora Neale Hurston's latest novel that they found and published recently, and then Ernest J. Gaines' latest novel? Do you have those two on there? If not, I will email you those titles.
Email them to me, please, and they're going up immediately.
I will email both of those to you. Gaines' work was just published very, very recently. And the one by Hurston was, I think, 2018. I think that one was published then. I'll get those titles to you.
Please do.
I have enjoyed it. Thank you for this opportunity. It's been fun.
It has, and you have a great NPR voice.
Oh, thank you. NPR, did you hear this? I love NPR. NPR, did you hear? I would love to do something for you.
Yeah, I'm saying. Oh, wait, before we go, tell them your involvement in the American Folklore Society.
What do I do for them, you mean? I show up at the conferences, and I love folklore in ways that I cannot even begin to express, honestly. And that's saying something for somebody who talks a lot. But folklore is, and the Folklore Society, the American Folklore Society itself, is such an incredibly welcoming space. We are certainly working on some the strategic plan. We are moving forward with goals for the next 5 years. We welcome new voices. We welcome new people. We welcome you. If you are in any way interested in the American Folklore Society, becoming a part of it, just seeing who the heck we are, you feel free to contact me. And I am just rolling off of the board. I was a board member for the last 3 years, and 2019 was my last year on the board. I'm staying on as the three members who rolled off of the board in 2019 have been asked to continue assisting with the finalization of the strategic plan, which we have all agreed to do throughout 2020. But know that I am committed to the American Folklore Society. I'm committed to its growth. I'm committed to its growing diversity, or else I would never have been on the board. You give your time and your heart to the things that you love. And I love that society. And it matters to me that it continues to be strong. And so I encourage your listeners who might even think that they might be interested in folklore, or who wonder if the thing that they're doing is in any way folklore related, I encourage them to reach out. You can reach out to me on Twitter or Instagram, or if you can contact Lamont at his email address or Absolutely. His contact information. We know people who know people who know people. So know that we welcome your presence at the Folklore Society. We welcome your presence in this field, in this discipline, and we will be made stronger because you are there.
You heard it here. All right. And I agree, by the way, but you heard it here. Okay. So folks, look out for that chapter and the book. Go back and read the old excerpts and chapters, and happy folklorism.
Happy folklorists. Folklorists are some of the best people in the world. Don't ever doubt it.
Jack Dapper Blues Heritage Preservation Foundation is a tax-exempt 501c3 nonprofit private foundation. Your donations, sponsoring, and funding allows us to create content that raises awareness of African-American traditional music, African-American folklore, and the Black experience. Check the link in the description box to donate. If you wish to sponsor podcasts, documentary series, or underwrite ads in our upcoming newspaper, The African American Folklorist, launching February 5th, 2020, contact the email address in the description box.